In partnership with Kura KiwiSaver, the Everyday Investor is proud to present News of the Money World, an informative, informal, yet hopefully entertaining look into all the latest happenings in the wonderful, yet overly complicated world of finance. Take a look at the world through the eyes of the markets. As usual, all content is provided on the basis of listener beware. Our views are often our own and definitely shouldn't be relied on for any investment decision. Let's get started. This is episode 69, Rupert. Congratulations, no 69 jokes. Welcome. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you? That's 69 episodes. That's a lot. So that means we're probably, because we started out fortnightly. So that must mean almost 2 years worth of this.
I think so. I think, like, I remember sitting in the same desk about 2 years ago talking to you about Bitcoin, I think. Trying to convince you it was a good idea. I don't know if that's a good idea or not. But yeah.
Well, no, do you know why that is a good idea, Darcy, and why your success? Because do you know what was the best performing KiwiSaver fund for the last quarter?
Tell us.
It was KiwiSaver cryptocurrency fund.
That's phenomenal. Was it really?
Up 76% on the quarter.
Yeah.
And even now when we look back at kind of over the last 12 months, so actually it'll be later in the week where it'll be 12 months since we've launched it, the fund is up about 10%. And I'll be honest, not many equity funds are up 10% in the last 12 months.
It's just a cool example though, because I remember probably 2 years ago or close to it, we were talking about how there was that probably like a golden number around about that 3% mark in a typical portfolio. Obviously, yeah, this is not exact science, but where it could increase the probability of high returns without increasing the volatility too much. And case in point, right? Like if you had a small sliver of what you're investing in do exceedingly well, like Bitcoin has this year, then I guess that makes up for the lack of performance, perhaps, that other portions. That's kind of the idea, right?
Oh, look, it is. And I think, and it also smooths out, it zigs when the others zag, right? So it creates a smoother portfolio, which we know how important the emotional side of investing is. And actually, it is quite interesting, right? So if you go, for example, like I talked to one of our Bitcoin clients last week, he joined us in October, admittedly got his market timing extremely right. He's up 30% since he joined, since he joined Kura. And that's because of a combination of timing the markets, et cetera. But I think for anyone that's put this in their portfolio, it's just giving them that little bit extra that's allowed them to feel good and allowed them to do well when in a pretty tough time for market. So
yeah, right.
I think it's done what we had hoped it would do. And it'll be interesting to see how much more uptake it gets. I mean, I will be honest, we have been a little bit surprised at the lack of uptake.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we've got about a couple of hundred members in that fund. It's sitting at about $1.3 million. Okay. We had assumed it would be a bit more popular than it is because it's such an easy way to invest in crypto, but we will see.
Yeah, and I think we can talk about the merits or the shortfalls or the pros and cons until cows come home, but often, even though we know we shouldn't do this, and you and I are in the same category, right? When things do take off and become hugely popular and have a run-up in price, you naturally feel like that's the time you want to get in, right? So fear of missing out drives you into it. And right now, or even the last 6 months, while it has been a good time to invest in it, perhaps, like from recent history's perspective, good luck, right? Because people don't feel like it. And I know we shouldn't invest with our feelings, but unfortunately, we still do. And so, do you think it'll probably change though? Like, do you think when the next, like as we approach the halving cycle, do you think
and we find it quite interesting at the moment, right? I think when you tell people cryptocurrency is the best performing asset of the quarter or of the last 6 months, they laugh at you. Now everyone thinks that crypto's dead and crypto's still in the doldrums. And I think as we talked about at an investment committee last week, unfortunately, how you describe it is exactly right. The price will get back to $40,000 and then the media will get interested. Everyday people will start to get really interested in it and get excited by it. It's the curse of the retail investor, unfortunately. You're very good at buying high, selling low.
Yeah. 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 And it's hard. It's hard though, isn't it? So I guess
very hard.
Time will tell. And that's why we do these things, right? It's not about picking stocks and figuring out which way the market's going to go, although that is quite entertaining and fun. it's just really about education. And so today, let's keep doing that. I'm just looking for my phone so I can do the old 6 minute timer. We've just wasted 3 minutes talking about Bitcoin. That wasn't a waste though. So let's get stuck into it. We're going to be talking about the debt ceiling, the budget here in New Zealand, the official cash rate, the OCR, and we're going to finish up on a bit of China. So
nice.
Let's get started with the U.S. debt ceiling. And I've been kind of watching this with interest because I've been just today, I've been trying to run an article around this and getting my head around how it works in the United States. It is quite different. And it feels like this game, right? Where one side will pressure the other side not to act and not approve just to get almost coerce some change out of the government that, you know, has to hold a tight line. So yeah, like what do you think? Do you want to maybe start by explaining to us what the debts, actually, do you mind if I explain what the debt ceiling is?
Because, yeah, dude, go for it.
This one. Okay. So, and keep in mind, I'm still just learning. I'm trying to find the document where I wrote this down on. I'm going to find it in time, but from what I understand, 1917, or prior to 1917, the U.S. had to basically vote for an increase to the debt ceiling. And what the debt ceiling is kind of like a credit limit. So if a government is able to collect some taxes from people to cover its spending, everything's all good. But if not, they need to borrow, which means they need to issue debt. And when 1917 happened, they effectively voted to have like a ceiling, so they wouldn't always have to ask for permission. But over history, of course, we've been banging up against that ceiling repetitively. And that's exactly what's going on right now. About 10 years ago, it happened in a similar way, and it will continue to happen. And it just means, it's just confirmation that the U.S. is basically run on debt, and they use their U.S. dollar, the global reserve currency status, as a way to basically fund their deficit. And so now we're in this standoff, right, Rupert, where we've got the situation where we need to go up again, but no, we want some responsibility, right? So talk us through it.
Yeah, so effectively, it's as you said, Congress needs to approve any increases in the debt limit. And so we now have a Republican-controlled Congress. We have a Democratic-controlled Senate and also a Democratic White House. And so effectively what needs to happen is Joe Biden needs to go and ask Congress to increase this level. And because the US politics are so fractious, they're basically saying no. And they're also saying, so look, we're happy to increase the debt limit, but only if you give us major concessions on spending. So they're asking for significant cuts to spending to make sure that the debt to kind of help rein in the future debt limit. And this doesn't sound all that unreasonable. When you put it like that and saying, well, with a Republican argument, hey, the debt limit's unsustainable. We are handcuffing our future generations to this huge debt and doing this. To which the Democrats say, yeah, we agree with that. So let's unwind some of the tax cuts that Trump brought on. Let's clean up some of the tax code. And the Republicans go, no, we're not touching the tax side of it. We're only going to entertain a conversation if you guys stop spending. And by the way, you're not allowed to stop spending on defense. You're not allowed to stop spending on Social Security. There are two or three other things that they're not allowed to. So it actually makes it really hard for the government to kind of reduce the spending because there isn't a huge amount of discretionary spending that they can reduce as well. So yeah, so and this kind of happens on a far too regular basis. And so what happens if they default? So effectively what happens is that the Treasury, the US Treasury, will not be allowed to go and issue new Treasury bills or bonds to investors. And so again, there'll be the US government, they will therefore have to prioritize where they spend their money. And so that means that some people in core roles will still be paid, but a lot of other people will not be paid. And most importantly, or from a financial markets perspective, most importantly, the people with treasury bills that are maturing during this period, those treasury bills will not be paid. And so effectively, so if you put yourself in the position of a bank, you've got a liquidity position, you've got a treasury department that's kind of planned out your liquidity profile over the next kind of 10 years, hopefully. And all of a sudden, the payment and the treasury bill that they held, where they were expecting payment on the 1st of June, they don't get paid. Mm. And now that, even though it's only kind of hopefully for a week or for a short period of time, they're holding a treasury bill, which is technically worth zero.
And so to put this in just in context of like someone who might have had experience with or knows how it works with an insolvency event, it's kind of like that, right? Where one chain of events causes multiple chain events afterwards, and then you've got a real crisis on your hands, right?
Oh, exactly, right? So you've got the banks going to sit there and go, well, okay, well, we're not going to get the money from the government. So what do? We probably can't pay out our deposits. And it just sets off it has the potential to set off an absolutely cataclysmic set of issues. And that's the key reason why, historically, we haven't actually seen the default happen. What happens every time is it runs down to the absolute last minute. Yeah. And all of a sudden they manage to make a deal on the at 11:59 on the last day. Yeah. And part of, unfortunately, it's all about the politics. Republicans don't want to be seen to be giving in. And at the same time, Democrats, well, neither side can really be seen to be giving in here.
Yeah, that's right. So as this standoff, I wouldn't call it a Mexican standoff because the Mexicans are not standing, they're walking through the borders. But it's definitely some sort of standoff situation, isn't it?
Hard out. And that's the unfortunate reality of it. So, and that's why I think, as most people talk about it, it's one of those events that's a 2-3% probability of actually happening. But actually, if it happens, the impacts are pretty significant.
And it's not so much the impacts of just that one thing either, right? Like, it's the impacts of that, plus the fact that there's a war going on, plus the fact that there's a banking crisis that's kind of going on as well. And hey, we're also out of firepower with dealing with inflation. We're kind of boxed into a corner. So there's a lot of issues that are really stacked up. So it's like, hey, this is the worst possible time to have a little bit of a family argument when you're on holiday, right?
Oh, completely. And then the third one, right, is where you're sitting there going, the US at the moment is telling us that they are the rule of law and they're the kind of the safe, easy country, right? So yeah. China, Russia, others going, well, why is anyone dealing in US dollars? Why is anyone doing with this when they can't even pay their bills? So
yeah,
it is a truly amazing kind of outcome.
Yeah.
It lands where it does.
Yeah.
Which is, I think everyone gets this, which is why the theater will play out and the theater will eventually resolve itself at 11:59.
I certainly hope so. Yeah. And so talking about spending, let's flip on over here to New Zealand now. So we've had a budget announced last week. And I generally am not a fan of politics just because they're all just a bunch of Muppets. So just putting that out there, because I'd hate to make it sound like I'm siding with one or the other, because I know that they're both teams are equally capable of spending money in areas that don't actually increase productivity or move the needle on anything. And it's almost like our version of what's happening sort of in overseas in the US, right? Because New Zealand historically hasn't really been a huge borrower in the past, potentially to our detriment. We were talking about this before we hit record. Right now the attention is, well, let's get more tax revenue from the rich. Meanwhile, by not pulling back on somewhat redundant government spending, in my view, that creates more of an inflationary problem. And because many New Zealanders are really just going to be bought basically by handouts, rather than understand the economics behind this and how inflation effectively is a tax, it's pretty scary right now just what direction the country seems to be going in. Obviously, I've probably got stronger views than many in this one, so I'll probably shut up on this one. But your general high-level thoughts, Rupert, around the budget?
Look, I think it was an interesting budget. It was a budget that was clearly designed to win the middle class. When you go things like healthcare, public transport, free public transport for kids, increasing under twos, childcare for under twos, or for two-year-olds, sorry, free prescriptions. It was really a budget that was set to kind of win those kind of middle class voters that might swing in between with a few little bribes, for want of a better set of words. I think the disappointing thing was that we didn't see the cost savings that I think a lot of people had been hoping for.
Yeah.
The government's clearly spending way too much at the moment. The level of spending today versus where it was, and the outcomes that we're receiving for that spending. Yeah, I think that is the broad issue. But I think it to me, it raises there's a really interesting point that was raised in that article I was showing just before from Liam Dan. And it's the first time that a politician in New Zealand's kind of said, look, hey, we are borrowing. We're going to keep on borrowing. And we've got no real issue with debt sitting at kind of 40% gross, 20% net, because actually we think that's fine. And I think, you know what, I do actually kind of subscribe to that view, because I think, and that's where the transformational part of this budget is. It's probably one of the first budgets where people haven't promised a quick return to surplus, which never really happens, but at least they all promise it. And it's because fundamentally New Zealand's debt levels are by far and away some of the lowest in the OECD. At the government level, there are very high levels of personal debt. And what that means is I think that has meant that we have been unwilling to invest in infrastructure. We've been unwilling to invest in productivity growth and actually do anything to drive our economy forward, because we keep on investing for yesterday rather than investing for tomorrow. We've got a roading system that does not work and is completely inadequate. We don't have a rail network. We don't have any transport infrastructure. Mm. We've got a hospital system that was built for 2 million people, not 5 million people. And I think, it's to a certain extent, we need to unshackle ourselves from this arbitrary 20% number that all the politicians seem to think is important. But at the same time, when we do that, we need to spend properly. And I think that's the major issue that we see in that budget. We don't actually see any true reining in of spending and actually doing things better.
Hey, please excuse the quick ad break. Where's your KiwiSaver invested? You don't know? You don't care? Well, with Kura, you have the ability to invest some of your KiwiSaver into some pretty cool things, which kind of makes it hard not to care about. Property, clean energy, and a carbon neutral crypto specialty fund. These are all now available to bolt on to a plan that's been tailored just for you using their digital advice tools. Of course, they have the usual low-cost traditional funds to make up the core of your KiwiSaver portfolio, but now you get to exercise a bit of choice too. After all, it's your money. To learn more about Kura KiwiSaver and their specialty funds, check out the product disclosure statement and visit kurawealth.co.nz. Now back to the show.
And that's the thing, right? Like if it was a household and you were thinking about borrowing more to do some repairs or maintenance on your home, on one side, awesome. We've got access to money and we can make our home better for everybody who's living in it. That's fantastic. But unless that's done in conjunction with higher income or cost savings to absorb the future interest cost of that, it's actually the stupidest thing to do. So maybe 20% is right, unless we get our productivity up or our cost down, which both seem to be struggling. So do you think that is realistic to actually think that this won't cause a downstream problem for future generations if we get into more debt?
I don't think it will cause issues. How material those issues are, I don't know. I mean, your analogy is really interesting, actually. I was just thinking about it. I mean, New Zealand, if you think about it, it's sitting there going, 5 years ago, we all moved into Ponsonby. We decided we loved eating out. We loved shopping in the expensive shops. We loved doing all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. We've now gone and had 3 kids. So we've gone from kind of our initial 2.5 bedroom house. Now got 5 people crammed into it. But we still want to eat out. We still want to shop at the expensive shops. And we still think we need to move into a 5-bedroom home in the same suburb tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically the game that we're playing. We all acknowledge we need to move to the 5-bedroom home, but we probably need to stop eating out. We probably still need to stop going to the expensive shops. And I think that's what New Zealand wants right now. We want to see good execution and fiscal discipline with an ongoing investment. And that's what we're not seeing.
Yeah. And I know every politician is going to tell you whatever that you need to hear this year, right? And to be honest, like every political leader scares the heck out of me in terms of incompetence or hidden agendas. Yeah, it's just, I can't honestly take a side. It's just so hard to vote this year. I will vote, but it's going to be hard, right?
Yeah.
But really, it's the plan. It's got to be down to business. We have to, as New Zealanders, I think, learn a little bit more about how these things actually work and keep our politicians accountable if we can, because
I think we do, but how we do that, I don't know. I think a bigger question, which is definitely not for here, is, but how do we actually get good people into politics? Because I think that's probably one of the issues that we have at the moment.
Yeah.
There is no one really that on either side of the spectrum that you sit there and go, I can get behind that person and I can support that person.
Yeah. Yeah.
But coming back to the budget, I mean, one of the things, and I think the commentary from some of the opposition around it being an inflationary budget, I'm not 100% sure I agree with that. It was probably not the deflationary budget that I think some were hoping for, and particularly the opposition were hoping for.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, right, that was never going to happen. You're never going to get a Labor government giving you a deflationary budget.
No, or we'd never probably be able to get any government doing that, to be honest, right?
Bill English was pretty good at that. Bill English, to give him some credit, was very good at the deflationary budget.
Okay.
But I'll just come back to my previous comment. We've got an education and healthcare system that's now built for 2.5 million people, not 5.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's right. And there's probably a need to be...
There's a middle ground.
Yeah, that's right. There is a middle ground there, isn't there? So you mentioned that you don't believe it would be as inflationary as some commentators have suggested. Let's just say it was, for argument's sake.
I want to disagree with you, but I'm not going to say I disagree.
No. I don't know enough, to be honest, around all the dumb stuff they spend money on. I know they do, though. I know they're spending.
Oh, there's a huge amount of the dumb stuff they do.
Yeah. So, and I don't know enough about how much of that inflation is actually contributed to by that incompetency. I'm just going to suggest that it's far better for us to support charities and take more personal responsibility. That's where I'll probably leave it. But when it comes to the official cash rate, which is the primary tool that we're obsessed with, I guess, maybe a little bit too much as homeowners because we're so heavily in debt, it's going to be reviewed this week. I think at the time that people are listening to this, it's going to be tomorrow. And if it goes up, it's because there's still inflation to be dealt with. And this budget isn't necessarily helping bring inflation down. But effectively, more of the heavy lifting required to deal with that inflation is going to be carried by the Reserve Bank. Higher for longer is what I would reluctantly predict.
Yeah, I think, like all good governments that have run out of ideas and run out of things to do.
Tax the rich? Tax the rich?
No. They've kind of gone, well, how do we drive growth? And what have they done? They've just hit the turbocharge button on immigration, which is the equivalent of a cocaine hit straight into kind of a tired kind of 2 a.m. bender.
Yeah.
And that's what this is. So fundamentally,
he's speaking from experience here, Rupert.
No, this is just what talking about. This is what people talk about.
All right.
So you kind of sit there at the moment and I look at the immigration numbers. It looks as though 100,000 kind of they're expecting this year, which is absolutely humongous.
Yeah.
You've got cyclone recovery, which is another $14 billion coming in this year.
Yeah.
Look, it's going to create a huge amount of economic stimulus, those two things, right? They're going to get growth. The immigration should push wages down, so stop some of the wage growth. But actually, that's going to require significant infrastructure spending. That's also going to kind of provide a cushion underneath house prices. And so when you put all of that kind of stuff together, you go, and also, sorry, it'll also get rid of some of the labor shortages that are currently kind of stopping some of the production. So to me, those two things indicate that actually, and I think quite a few in Treasury actually did come out with this last week, that the recession that we're expecting to have at the end of this year, maybe it doesn't hit us anymore. All of a sudden we might be able to get ourselves through this without a recession. And I think what we've been talking about the whole way through, the only way interest rates come down, and I'd probably even say the only way interest rates don't stop going up, is recession. Unfortunately, what does this mean for everyday New Zealanders? It probably means high population, potentially wage growth stops, but we're going to keep on with inflation because we've got a whole lot of other things going on, and we're going to continue having higher interest rates. But at least from everyone's perspective, we'll print good GDP numbers, so we'll look good. It's just not going to feel very good for the average Kiwi.
Yeah, and it would be interesting just to get some more clarity. I haven't dug into the immigration numbers. Massive amount. Are they the right type of people to help grow the economy, right? Like, it's an easy sugar hit, like you say, and it's been done before, and it's a way to goose up the numbers pretty easily, but it does have downstream implications, right? So
massive. And I think, yeah, who knows, right? But I think, unfortunately, yeah. So the idea, to me, that is hands down Mazarin going, okay, we're giving up on productivity now. And we're just focused on absolute growth, which brings us back to the world that we've been in for the last 10, 15 years, unfortunately.
That's right. That's right. Now, speaking of populations, if I can engineer a segue that's graceful here, I will. So populations, aging populations, demographics. China has probably one of the worst demographic problems in the world. So speculation increasing that maybe the China growth story is a little bit overcooked and maybe they're not actually doing as well as we've been told over the past few years. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, so look, this has come out of a really interesting article that I was reading over the weekend in The Economist. And I think the prevailing set of theories for a very long time was that China, as a share of global GDP, could kind of grow and pretty quickly would surpass the US. And it would keep on growing, and that it was only a matter of time before the US would become a distant number two. Mm. But actually, what the research from a few different kind of outlets is starting to show, actually, no. I mean, some people are saying, yep, it will get bigger. There are now starting to be the odd forecast that says it won't even get bigger. But more importantly, the signs of what you're starting to see in that Chinese market and the Chinese economy, everyone's saying, okay, cool, it'll get a little bit bigger. It will overtake the US, but it's actually not going to completely take off. And that's down to a few reasons, right? One is we've seen most of the productivity gains have happened. So the productivity and the gains that you've seen in China over the last kind of 30, 40 years, bringing it from a very, very, very low base, we're kind of starting to slow down a lot faster than everyone thought, right? So this whole convergence idea is starting to kind of go away. Mm. Plus, you bring the aging population. You've got a population that will that's going to kind of half over the next 50 to 100 years. And that's going to cause some real issues. The third issue that's going to be driving a lot of this change is the fact that you now have a massive technological disadvantage for China with the trade wars and with the sanctions on chips and other kind of high-end advanced technologies. Increasingly, it's going to become really, really, really hard for China to compete because they can no longer rely on importing and arguably stealing a lot of the technology from the West. And I think this is actually going to have massive implications for the world and for the world economics, right? And sorry, the world politics, because all of a sudden you've started to see, it's been an interesting journey, right? So you had the offshoring to China as they went through this productivity boom. Actually, what's been more interesting over the last 5 years, you've seen the offshoring away from China moving to other economies, Vietnam, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, other economies which have kind of become easier to deal in, more welcoming, etc. But unfortunately, you've only just got the politics which has caught up to all of this. And it's probably only in the last 3 years, 4 years that you've kind of started to see the tension between the US and China or in China and the rest of the world. And that's largely been driven by kind of the fact that everyone assumed China would quickly become the number one economy and continue to grow. And so I do wonder whether actually if this revised view becomes mainstream, and as this probably, let's be honest, once a forecast starts to decline, it only continues to decline. Once it becomes pretty clear that China will only ever become slightly bigger than the US, if that at all, does that change the whole political situation that we've currently got and a lot of those global tensions that we currently see?
Okay. So when I think about how China has been portrayed in the last, say, 5 to 10 years, like what you're saying, it does kind of speak to this theme that America itself has almost forgotten what made it great in a way. And I think made that easy to just think that, hey, if China has been growing at this rate, of course it's going to reach parity and it's going to go beyond, because they've forgotten some of the core fundamental pillars that American culture sits on. And I'm no fan of the USA necessarily, a little bit further north to actually care about that, but it doesn't seem that surprising in a way when you think about what made America great. You know, like even just the fact that the access to natural resources, trading partners, population, China has issues there, and it's got a lot more constraints. And so I don't know. Like to me, it's kind of like they've been probably goosing the numbers a little bit from inside the red curtain there. And so now it's kind of like, well, they can't really hide it for much longer. Their opportunity to capitalize on this image that China is a big weight throwing itself around the world, I guess that's probably a finite period of time where they could act confidently, right? Because at some stage, they're going to have to turn the focus back on themselves.
And there is an argument for that is when they're at their most dangerous.
Yeah.
Because actually, fundamentally, you end up in a world where, the fear of their size and the fear of their might is potentially far more powerful than the reality of the not so mighty. And does that mean the Taiwan situation actually becomes more and more dangerous?
Yeah. Yes, the Taiwanese, I think they're probably a little bit just too used to that threat to actually be concerned about it. But I don't know. It's like you need a really dominant power in the world just to keep things in play. It's like, it's the hen house, right? So if you don't have one chicken, I have chickens outside my door here. And so I've been feeding the chickens this morning and just seeing how it's dominated by one chicken. And so you take that chicken out and it's disorder for a while, right? Until there's a new pecking order established. And I think if either the U.S. grows a pair and actually starts to lead a little bit more effectively, and we might not like what that means, or maybe the runway falls short for, say, Russia and China, and they have to kind of attend to other matters and become minor players again in the worldwide stage. That almost has to happen. I know it's not necessarily the right thing to suggest, but that almost has to happen for stability, in my view.
Interesting.
We need China to be there, though. They're buying our milk here in New Zealand. So,
oh, look, we need China there more than anything, right? So we need it.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, I think we did it. I think we covered those four topics, 6 minutes each-ish. We covered a lot of them. So yeah, I'm pretty proud of that. I think next week, let's maybe dig into some more current events. We're spoiled for choice at the moment. Before it was like, well, let's just pick one thing to talk about, but there's just so much stuff going on.
Exactly.
Next week. That's cool. All right. Thanks very much, Rupert.
Okay. Well, thank you, Darcy. And we will speak to you. See you all next week.
Fantastic. Thanks for listening in, everyone. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.